I'm a little nervous tonight because what I'm about to tell you is extremely personal. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the last 5 or 6 months with having cancer. I'm in remission now. And the idea to speak tonight about this was inspired by Bob having sent me a copy of what you all discussed one night here at Crystal Springs. Bob brought in some readings of people who had dealt with serious illness. Was it all cancer? I can't remember. It was all cancer. And, you know, it was really like a great learning. I think the common thread that ran through these accounts was what a learning experience it was and how ultimately, you know, it was had some positive effect for people. And my experience has been so very different from that I feel I have to share this with you. It's not been negative. It's just that I haven't learned anything. But, you know, I'm the fourth horse. You know that parable. Anyway, the fourth horse, the first horse, as Suzuki Roshi tells the story, is very swift and learns very quickly. This is a Zen student who comes, just folds their legs and forever. And then there's the second and third, the various gradations in between. And then the fourth horse has to be beaten and whipped until they're bleeding and torn and broken, you know, to learn anything. So when Suzuki Roshi told that story, I was a very young student, and I thought, gee, I wonder if I'm the first horse. Oh, I really want to be the first horse. And as soon as he told the story, he said, the fourth horse is the best. I had no idea that I was the fourth horse then, of course. But I can attest to having it being necessary to be beaten and whipped until you're bleeding. So there are lots of actually different perspectives to tell this story from the story of my last few months. And I kind of go back and forth about tonight. I guess as I'm telling it, I guess I'm settling on a point of view, or a couple. I'll settle on two. One is, I really want to thank you. I have told you before. I gave a cancer lecture about a month ago at Green Gulch, and I have moved so beyond that talk in the short period of time. Emotionally, I've moved way beyond that talk. That talk is like kindergarten. But I still haven't learned anything. But emotionally, what's happening is getting deeper and deeper for me. I told that lecture from a non-preference point of view. And I love that point of view, and I will include that tonight because it's the Xin Xin Ming. I chanted it tonight. I almost cried tonight because I'm so aware of, I mean, I was aware that I was going to speak to you about this. But the first thing that is the most important point of view tonight is to thank you because your well-being ceremonies for me have made this possible for me to go through this with the equanimity and the non-preference that I have had. I never was afraid. I never thought I would die. And as time went on, I actually did not prefer my health. But I've practiced non-preference for many years. I mean, intentionally and consciously. In matters trivial and great, and this is a great matter, because one is very tempted to have preferences in this way. So the reason I'm thanking you is because of this, because I never was afraid, and because I didn't think I was going to die, you had to do all that alone. I was aware that my students around me, people flew in. These are long-distance students that moved away from the Bay Area and relocated in Oregon and Colorado. These, because I didn't shoulder my part of the burden, other people, you people, had to fear for me and be afraid I would die. And I was aware that this was going on, and I thought for a time I was in denial. You know, that I was in shock for some time, at least a month, maybe 6 weeks, in which I was just, oh my God, you know, this means I'm going to have to change my schedule radically. So I was in shock, in which I didn't feel much, but I have thoroughly engaged with this disease. I don't think I'm in denial. I did actually ask my acupuncturist at one point if he thought I was in denial. And he said, well, my experience is, he said, when people are diagnosed with cancer, they are very surprised and upset, and they completely reprioritize their lives to have a spiritual component. And he said, didn't you do that a long time ago? Haven't you done that already? And I thought, while I was on his table, I thought, what is really, realistically, the longest my life has ever been out of phase with my deepest desire? I mean, since I've been practicing, in the last 30 years, say. And at the most, it's been 3 months that it's out of phase with my deepest desire. And then I fix it. You know, I have a great deal of freedom in my life. So I have felt thoroughly engaged with this disease. I mean, I don't know how I could have gone through the hell of chemotherapy without being thoroughly engaged and determined to live. I don't know how I could take 50 pills a day of herbs without being engaged. I mean, I just... I mean, I feel like, on the one hand, I feel like a toxic waste dump. And on the other hand, I feel like, you know, this shining, pure example of nature's offering to the spirits or something. Anyway, I feel quite engaged. I don't believe that I, except for maybe the first month or so, that I have been in denial at all. Yet I can tell you that I don't think cancer is hard. I think that being a parent is hard. I think that being a friend is hard. I think that telling the truth is hard. I think that that being a human being with your feelings intact, keeping your feelings intact and resisting numbing over, is hard. Now, if I'd gotten cancer when I was 30, I would be saying a very different thing. But I am 64 years old. I have done really hard things. I have been a friend. I have been a parent. I have made a vow to tell the truth as I see it. That's a really difficult and painful one. And I have vowed many years ago to the best of my ability, keep my feelings intact and resist numbing over. Those things are hard things to do. Cancer is not hard compared to those. Again, this is from the perspective of a 64-year-old woman who has done these hard things, who is continuing to try to do these hard things. I find parenting now of a 32-year-old son as difficult as a 3-year-old. You know, I never got the knack of it. And I find telling the truth as difficult and painful as it was when I was first trying it out, a mere 5 years ago or so. So, I have a very different reaction than the people in the article, and I think that part of it, they sounded young to me. I don't remember how old they were. As I say, it would have been different for me if I'd been young. So this journey, well, plus cancer, as it's been explained to me, is not like some disease that came and I'm now fighting this disease like a cold or something. It's not a foreign body, it's me. And because it's me, I can kind of understand where it went wrong, you know. I kind of have some sympathy for, you know, cells that started out as good cells and then they just went deviant. It happens to the best of us. So these chemos have been really terrible, really a lot of misery. But again, it's just like the rest of life, you know, misery and sadness. Sometimes I feel when I'm lying there sick and weak, like life is just a veil of tears, like I could just cry and cry and cry. And that's not just the chemo. That's because I feel sick and weak and sad for all the suffering, the suffering that I'm doing and, you know, the suffering that other people do. And then the sun breaks through the windows and I'm happy again. And then I'm, you know, have another wave of nausea and I'm miserable again. And so on and so on. It's just like everything else. It's not different. So I'm sorry that you had to shoulder the death and the fear kind of thing. But I really thank you for doing it. I really, you know, I believe in you know, we're all one. We're all interconnected. And what I don't feel, you feel. What I don't shoulder, you shoulder. And you shouldered it for me. And you said well-being for me. And that I really got. That I really got. I, as low as I have been in terms of pain and just kind of a whimpering animal type of mentality, I also have felt born on a, you know, a sheet by angels. That's been very clear to me. I told you that before. I have felt picked up and lifted up by the well-being ceremonies for me. They've been very palpable. And this whole thing of non-preference, you know, non-preference is mysterious. I mean, that word is mysterious, but actually, the practice of non-preference is extremely accessible. It's merely noticing your preference and then randomizing things. I mean, that's what life does to us. We might as well keep a step ahead of the curve or something like that. I love this quote by Lin Shib Rinzai, which is, if all the Buddhas in the 10 worlds appeared before me, I would not rejoice. And if the three hells appeared before me, I would not fear them. And why is this? Because there is nothing to dislike. And I feel a lot the same. There's nothing to dislike. Yes, one would rather not be nauseous. Yes, one would rather not be suffering. But somewhere in the world, there is someone suffering. So why not suffer at the same time? There is so much difference between suffering by yourself and suffering at the same time that other people are suffering. I think that must be what liberation means. Because if you wish to be liberated from suffering, you'd live a very solitary and isolated life. You wouldn't be able to relate to other people. But yet, it's tremendously liberating to hold each other's hands as you go to hell. It's very heartwarming. So the actual practice of non-preference that I've done for many years is in trivial things. And I'm sure I've told you the ice cream story, right? I haven't. Okay. The first time it ever occurred to me to practice non-preference, I was in an ice cream store. And I was trying to get the most intense chocolate experience possible. So I was looking at all the chocolate flavors and saying, well, that actually has chunks of chocolate in it, and that, blah, 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 and that's dark chocolate. And that. So I'm, you know, strategizing, and then it just occurred to me like a lightning flash. This is the way people transcend their karma, by the way. There's no reason for it. It just strikes you like a lightning, and you're free. You're free. There was no reason for you to be free, but you're now free. That's what happened to me in the ice cream store. I suddenly thought, oh, why don't I just cover my eyes, back away from the counter, and go like that? It's all good. So I did that, and much to my horror, it was orange sherbet. I'm not a fruit person. I don't even eat oranges, except in the summer. And I thought, well, I don't have to go through with this. And then I thought, yes, I will. So I walked out of the store with an orange sherbet cone. And I licked it, and it was really good. First of all, sherbet melts faster on your tongue. I noticed that right away. I hadn't had sherbet before. And the way the fruit flavor was in this sweet cone was delightful. It was refreshing, it was sweet, it was cold, it was a whole different thing than chocolate. I mean, really different. It was like a whole world opened up to me. Just like the first time I ever went to McDonald's. I at first thought hamburger, you know, compared it with all the hamburgers I'd had in my life, and it was wanting. But if I took it as just itself, it was its own experience. Well, the orange sherbet was like that, and it opened a world to me. Now, if I would have gone to my grave without ever having had that experience if I had gone with my preference. And so that really struck me that day, because I thought, well, preference is kind of, it's not only self-indulgent and deadening in a way, it's repetitious. It's always chocolate. My whole life, it's always chocolate. And here was inroads in my experience. So then I just started doing that kind of practice in restaurants, you know, again, I say in very trivial ways, choosing the third thing down on the menu, you know. And just reaching into my underwear drawer and just taking the underpants that my hand picks. And, you know, this is difficult because I have about 10 pair of underpants that I really like. And I would wear them all the time and ignore the others if it weren't for this practice. So the reason I actually think it's important to practice non-preference in trivial ways is because if you don't do this, if you always go with your preference in every situation, just the statistical weight of making that choice again and again and again and again not only limits your experience, not only puts all your worldly experience through a filter of preference that are formed very young. Our preferences are actually formed very young. And so to have that filter on your experience for the rest of your life is kind of sad. But the statistical weight when you get to be, you know, 40 or 50 or 60 of always coming down for what you prefer, it really cuts off the possibility that you will have other kinds of experience. Just statistically, you're going into a narrower and narrower and narrower tunnel all the time. So I think it is very important to practice non-preference in trivial ways, and so that when it does matter, when it is harder, health versus cancer, ignoring it versus, you know, chemotherapy or something like that. For a very brief time at the beginning of this, I thought that I might just do nothing. And if I'd been in isolation, I probably would have done nothing. But it was clear that I was not alone in this decision. I mean, I could not make this decision in a vacuum. And, I mean, because of all of you. In one way, it's been very easy. When I say cancer is not hard, what I mean specifically for me is it's been easy because you have shouldered the fear and the death stuff. But also, my life is extremely stable. It has been the same life for at least 20 years with Zazen as its center. And then radiating out from that are people, connections. So I'm one of the jewels in Indra's net. I mean, you are too. But, I mean, I feel if I look in any direction, it goes straight into another jewel. I have felt for some time, and I'm not unique in this way, I think not only any Zen priest, but any clergy person basically has no life that's apart from other people. There's not some little life that I'm hiding in a closet. In fact, when Tony, my husband, and I talked about how we would handle access to me, it was clear that, I mean, I had to be as open and available during my throwing up as, I mean, I have been at all other times. So people came in and people, you know, cleaned me up and people put me in the bathtub and people did various things. So what I'm saying is it was easier because of the life I already had, very stable and very open. So it just so happens that those conditions, very stable and very open, are extremely healing, for one, and they are also they create ease and comfort and harmony. So I feel like the conditions of my life were already in place for some kind of catastrophe like this. It couldn't be better. In fact, Louise was in a class, as several of you were, that I interrupted, and then took up again a couple months later. And I thought, that class, actually, now that you're here, Louise, that class actually was very important to me at the time, because when I was reluctant, I was very reluctant to tell that class the circumstances. I can't remember what I said. I think I said I was diagnosed with cancer and then didn't go on. And I think there was a woman in the class who said, well, tell us. And the reason I didn't go on, you know, spontaneously by myself is because there were about, I'd say about two-thirds of the class were very close to me, you know, people from here. And you and other people were not so close to me. And so I felt like it would be a burden to go on with details to strangers, to almost strangers. But I think it was Susan Weisberg, actually, who was a student of mine from San Francisco, said, well, tell us. We need to know everything. So she educated me right on the spot about what was comforting and what was not. But that class, I interrupted. And then when I took it up again a couple months later, people came. People came to the class again. It wasn't just lost and forgotten. And so, again, that indicated for me almost physically the amount of stability that I could count on in my life. So the circumstances of this have not, I mean, I know that cancer can be hard, but it has not been for me. And it's because of you and the circumstances of my life. And I don't know how to thank you except to just continue to be with you forever. I'm very grateful. So now that I'm in remission, it's 5 years until I'm considered cured, because it can always come back. But again, this, you know, I thought, as I was telling Keith, by the way, has been my medical advocate. I mean, that's his official title. And he's gone with me to every doctor's appointment. He was there waiting after the surgery, where they removed the tumor and everything else they could possibly find. And so he, too, his presence and willingness to hold my hand through all the doctor's appointments have, again, been another source of stability and connection. I mean, nobody is as lucky as I am. I mean, I wish this kind of luck and this kind of care for every sick person. It's remarkable. It's just remarkable. Not only because of my husband's health care insurance have I had access to the best medical treatment, but because of a fund that you all have contributed to, I've been able to have very good alternative health care as well, thus the herbs and the acupuncture. So Keith has been a big part of this, too. And I told him just a few weeks ago, I said, I think that the terrain, the five-year terrain, is going to be much more emotional for me. Maybe that's when I'll start feeling fear. But I don't yet, because, as a matter of fact, I am old. You know, if I make it through this 5 years, then something else will kill me. So I started thinking, now that I'm actually in this point of view, in the five-year point of view now, the chemo's behind me, the going into remission is behind me. It's half a dozen of one and six of the other. So it's not, again, it's not as fearsome as I thought it would be. So I'm sorry you have to be afraid all alone again. I'm just glad you're so strong. I hope that you're not still afraid. Anyway, thank you very, very much. Please feel free to make comments.
Experiencing your feelings without getting dead. Can you do that without getting into my rage and desire or anything else?
Could you speak a little louder, David? I have tinnitus from the chemo, and it sometimes overwhelms a soft voice.
You spoke of experiencing your feelings and not allowing yourself to become dead.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that without becoming overwhelmed by despair or rage?
Overwhelmed by despair or rage by sitting zazen, so that you are willing to be overwhelmed by despair and rage. So that you don't have a preference. Whatever comes through. Certainly despair and rage are preferable to numbness.
I would agree.
Okay. Here's to you.
Your idea that somebody else can fear for you sounded a little strange at first. But sitting here, I was thinking about an episode when I ended up in the hospital, and I was with Lisa and Rachel and Roland, and when I expressed my problem to them, it was very comforting, their concern, and I can sort of relax and say they will take care of me and do what is necessary. So that was very comforting. Maybe that's something related to what you were talking about, but not having to fear because other people are with you. Not that I wasn't afraid, I was afraid, but it helps to have the support of other people who sort of took it seriously and were there.
Yes, I think that is utterly undeniable. I'm talking on the level of psychic energy. Maybe it's most clear if you think of when someone refuses to take on a feeling, let's say you think something is a crisis and someone, well, I mean your position vis-a-vis me, and someone doesn't acknowledge it is a crisis, then you're left to shoulder the burden. Or in a husband and wife situation or two friends, if you both agree that this is a serious matter, or if you both agree that you're both angry, or you both agree that you have a problem in your relationship, then there's some sharing. But if one person denies that, then the person who perceives it has to do it all themselves. They have to do all the processing themselves. And it's very difficult. That's why I'm apologizing to you, because you had to do the processing. I did the scheduling. You did the processing.
I guess your apology is metaphoric.
Yeah, my apology is metaphoric. I don't think so. I actually feel sorry that you had to do this.
So we got the fear.
That's right.
It's all right.
Pardon?
That's all right.
Well, I remember you told me of your strong emotional reaction to my diagnosis, and I felt so badly. I mean, I'm very sorry for the strong feelings.
Sure beats being numbed over.
That's what friends are for.
Cause of grief.
What you leave yourself open for, wouldn't you?
make the connection. Yes.
That's right. When you become attached, that's what happens. You're all good Buddhists. You know this. This is the definition of attachment. Now, Buddha did not say, don't get attached. Buddha just said, if you do get attached, this is what happens.
Well, but, you know, I think you're sort of, maybe this is what Keith is trying to say, but I'm not sure, but you're setting up a double standard a little bit there. Like, fear doesn't have to be, fear is another emotion. It doesn't have to be twisted. It doesn't even have to be suffering. Fear can just be felt without it being suffering, just like the other emotions you're talking about. So I think you can trust that for us, fear is profound without necessarily being something that you need to apologize for us feeling. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know that it's about attachment. I think it's about actually awareness. Mm-hmm. We all were made particularly aware of your importance and particularly aware of the misery that you would be going through with your treatment. And not that we're not aware of these things in a general way all the time, but when you have an instance presented to you, someone you care about and feel close to, then you're really going to feel those things powerfully. And I don't think that's I don't know if that was unbalancing for us or unhealthy for us. So there's nothing to apologize for. And there's nothing for us to feel that we suffered, because I think we just experienced. And it's a privilege to be able to experience something with you.
Thank you. That actually broadens my understanding quite a bit, as when you said, it's gone out of, I mean, what you said was a prelude to what Lou said about it's gone out of my mind. What did you say just before? Gone out of yours too?
Yeah,
oh, it beats being numbed over. That's what you said. Yeah.
I don't know if the feeling of apology was metaphoric, because what we experienced was simply what you allowed us to participate in.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I want to thank you for expressing your feelings, and whatever you felt, I want to respect that and thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
I feel like, you have been ill, and then other friends of mine, it's like, it's a gift that the person that's ill or going through something gives to other people, to allow the other people to participate in some way. Because mm-hmm. I think for me, and I think for a lot of people, you just feel like, oh my gosh, I want to do something. It really brings up the I want to do something feeling. And so, so therefore participating in the well-being ceremony, for those of us who weren't in Burnville and weren't, people in Burnville, I think we're dropping off soup and doing things like that. And the same thing with contributing to a fund or whatever, it's a gift for us, because it allows us to be close to you and part of your life and connected. So in the same way that it really is that connection you feel is really good. And then also being part of the group, of course, it's very good too, because you're sharing it together. So, mm-hmm. I also have to feel truly thank you for, continuing to come and be with us. And, be part of getting the update sent out.
Well, of course, continuing to come here has been very important.
So, can I ask, was there anything about this experience that was light?
That was light?
That was light, that was funny, that was anatomy and individual, like I'm sure little things people would say sometimes would be off base or be funny, but in the bigger sense, was there anything about it that was lifting? And maybe that's a ridiculous expectation to have, but was there anything about it?
Well, of course, just as always, even in a bad day when things don't go your way, there's always humor and lightness and, you know, sudden, you know, scene that is empty of your bad feeling. All of that, it's just been like regular life. I mean, that's part of my point. It has all the qualities for me of regular life. You know, being down, being up in the same hour, and, you know, making remarks. My husband, I mean, one thing that was humorous that he always said was, I would say, gee, I don't want to go to this social occasion. And he said, you've got the cancer card, play it. You know? So there was, yes, that sense of infinite power that I have rarely experienced. Yeah, right, exactly.
I was amazed at what you said your brother said when he was diagnosed with cancer, and he said to Darlene, this sibling rivalry has got this one. I don't know. I mean, brave, it doesn't even, you know, touch it. Wonderful.
He also, when I was at my worst with rheumatoid arthritis many years ago and limped very badly, he had a motorcycle accident, so he limped very badly in the same leg. And one time we were walking down the street together in front of Zen Center, and a friend came up the other way, and we said, hey, Kim, want to go to lunch? And he said, nope, it looks catching. So thank you very much. Good night.